So in this story, we see the threes again. Did we see the threes? Who picked up on the threes? When you come together, and when you come together, and when you come together. He says it three times. Remember what I've told you about the power of the threes? Mm-hmm. Yeah, pay attention. The author's trying to tell you something. So we see Paul start off with three times saying, when you come together. When you come together, it's not for the better, it's for the worse. You hear that? It's almost better that you don't come together to have communion. That's how badly you're doing it. The second time, when you come together, there are divisions among you, I hear. Someone ratted them out. He says that Chloe's people have brought this to his attention earlier in the chapter. Chloe's people saw a problem, did their best to deal with it. It was not resolved, so they went and sent Paul a letter. And there are divisions. People are deeply divided. When you come together, the third time, he doesn't pull any punches. He says, it's not really the Lord's Supper that you're having. Can you imagine Paul saying that? That's not real communion. That's not real church. Can you imagine what was going on in that society that he's saying it's better that you don't even have communion? Because it's not even real communion because you're so divided that someone had to rat you out and tell me that there was a problem that you could not solve on your own. That's how bad it was. So let's talk about what was actually happening in that society. This was in the city of Corinth. It was a diverse population. And the Christian community in Corinth was made up of a wide segment of people. In that church, there were slaves. There were day laborers. And there were also people that actually were landowners, aristocrats that had a lot of money. And when they came together, they would have church and they would have communion. Now, communion, as they had it back then, was very different from what we have now. Now we have a small piece of bread dipped into a bit of wine. We have the ceremonial wafers in some churches, right? We have a little one cup to share amongst all the people in the church. Back then, it was much more like a potluck. Okay? When we talk about the Last Supper, it was a supper. They had supper together. Now, in supper, he did bless the bread and he did share the wine, but there was other food there too. So, in this meal that they were having, which was a potluck with this diverse group of people, we also see a bit of a culture clash because we see the Christian church and we see Greek culture coming together. We see the Christian church in its infancy trying to have a potluck, a gathering, with everyone in the church together sharing this meal to remember what Christ taught them. And at the same time, we see a Greek culture which said that when you have a party, it starts at 4 o'clock. That was what you do. It's like British tea time. What time is tea time in Great Britain? What? 4 o'clock. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. Is it written down someplace or do people just know? 4 o'clock, you sit down, you have some tea, you have some delicious snacks, right? A hearty meal, together time. You just know that's how it works in that culture. So, I want you to put on your thinking caps for a moment. You have day laborers, you have slaves, and you have wealthy landowners. The party starts at 4 o'clock. Who is going to most likely be hosting this party? The landowners, the people that have a house where they can host, right? Okay, and who's going to be bringing the bulk of the food and the wine? The wealthy landowners. And who's going to get there first?
The landowners.
The landowners, because it's their house and they have time. They have time to kill. So they can come at 4 o'clock. Who's going to get there next?
The slaves.
The day laborers. Why the day laborers? What time are they going to get there? 6 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, whenever it gets dark. That's right, because they would work from sun up till sundown, finish up their day, and then come over. So they'd probably get done around 6, get there around 7. Who gets there next? The slaves. What time do the slaves get there? When the masters go to bed. That's right. They finish feeding the master, getting the master ready for bed, putting them to bed, cleaning up the mess from dinner, and then they get to come. What time would they get there? Late 10, 11 o'clock at night. Exactly. Exactly. So imagine that you're there at 4 o'clock and the next group of people aren't going to get there till 7. Would you be able to wait? Would you be able to watch all your delicious roasted chicken get cold and your chilled wine get warm? Or would you have a couple glasses of wine and some cheese and crackers to pass the time? Would you be able to wait? No. No. And that's exactly what Paul talks about when he says, some people are going hungry while others are getting drunk. By the time the day laborers and the slaves got there, all the food would be gone and all the wine would be drunk and people were passed out on the floor. And there's empty platters everywhere with some greasy crumbs left over. And we kind of chuckle about this. Oh, isn't that terrible, terrible host behavior? But that was happening on a regular basis. And Chloe's people, whoever Chloe's people were noticing that this was having drastic consequences, because this wasn't just rudeness. It wasn't just sort of killing the mood of the party. But for day laborers and for the slaves, it was causing serious health consequences. When people would come to the cities to work from wherever they were out on their farms or their agricultural communities, their life expectancy once they got to the city was 6 months. That's how long people would last, because if you were working all day long and you don't receive decent wages to be able to buy decent food, they were primarily living on things like barley, and if they were lucky, some lentils on occasion for a little bit of protein. You cannot survive on that. Most of them could not make it as a day laborer, so often people would be forced to go into the sex trade, catch a disease. They did not have antibiotics back then, and people would get sick and die. For the wealthy landowners, this was just another party. But for the slaves and the day laborers that were part of that Christian community, that might be the only decent meal they got that week. The only meal that had fresh vegetables, the only meal that had a little protein in it. And it made the difference between life and death. That's why Paul says, I'm upset because I understand that because of what you're doing, many of our brothers and sisters have become ill and gone to sleep, died. That's why he's so upset. When you come together, it's not for the better, it's for the worse. You're not having the real Lord's Supper. This is not what Jesus meant when he said, do this in remembrance of me. So we have a couple of issues going on here. We have a sort of a cognitive dissonance with this church. And we see that Chloe's people tried to remedy it, and it didn't work. Chloe's people tried to solve this, and the community became divided over it. And we see this happened in churches today where they're trying to do the best they can, but they're causing more harm than good. And we see this level of cognitive dissonance where we don't really understand the concept of community. There's a quote from Craig T. Nelson. You remember the old show Coach? Remember Coach? You've seen Craig T. Nelson. He's been in a lot of movies. There's a wonderful quote from him from several years ago where he talks about when he was younger, before he made it as a big-time actor, and he was down and out. And he says, I had it bad. There was a time when I was on welfare. I was on food stamps. Did anybody help me? No. Welfare and food stamps is the entire country coming together to chip in so that you have a safety net. Did anybody help him? He thinks, no. Cognitive dissonance. He doesn't quite get the problem. And I think of a time when I went to visit a friend of mine up in Seattle. We were traveling through and I stopped in. Now he was a single man and I was there with my family. He was a college student. And he said, well, on Sunday I go to church, and we were going to be there on a Sunday. So he invited us to go to his church. Now he was attending an Asian church. The service was in English, but the entire community was Korean. And so we stayed for the service. And then after service, they said, well, we are going to invite you. We have lunch together. And this huge meal appeared out of nowhere. Huge pots of steamed rice, seasoned barbecued beef, spinach that had been cooked with sesame oil, sliced mushrooms that had been sautéed, all sorts of vegetables, and they served up bowls, these beautiful bowls filled with rice and meat and hot vegetables, and everyone sat down together and ate together. And I said, "Wow, this is so lovely. I did not know that your church did this." I said, "This must be really nice for you to come and be able to have this community." And he looked me straight in the eye and he said, "Yeah, I love coming to church and the people are really great. But honestly, as a college student who doesn't know how to cook, this is the only decent meal I get all week. This is the only decent meal he gets all week." And he got so much more. He got community. He got God. He got love. He got acceptance. He got to be able to dine with somebody else rather than sitting at home eating. I don't know what he ate. He couldn't really tell me. I think he had boxes of frozen something in his freezer that he subsisted on. And so this communal meal, even today, the concept of a communal meal makes a difference in people's lives. And so when we see this meal, this ancient meal falling apart, and people getting sick, we really understand Paul's anger over this. And we like to think that his letter sorted everything out, that, you know, the community was all sorted out after that point, and they got their act together, and they self-reflected, and everything was fine. But then, if that were true, there would never have been a second letter to the Corinthians. Because people make mistakes, because living community is hard. Because making sure that everybody is equal and everybody has enough takes a lot of effort. And it is human nature to want to take the best stuff and keep it for ourselves. My old Christian history teacher said that again and again, whenever people have good stuff, the first thing they want to do is put a fence around it and say, "This is mine. This is mine. You can ask permission. Maybe I'll let you have a little, but this is mine." And that's so contrary to what Christ taught us. And so Paul talks about what Christ taught us. He talks about that Last Supper, and he talks about what it's really supposed to be about. When you come together, how it's supposed to be for the better, how it's supposed to be unifying, not divisive, and how it's supposed to be true church, in capturing the true vision of what Jesus taught us. And so he talks about six different things, which I would like to share with you briefly. Six different things that communion is really supposed to be about. First of all, it's supposed to be about gratitude. Christ gave thanks for the bread. He blessed the wine. The concept of gratitude, whatever we have will be enough, and we are grateful for it. It is a gift from God. He talks about how the meal is supposed to be about remembrance. Christ says, "Do this in remembrance of me." We're supposed to remember our heritage. Remember that people have done this for thousands of years. We're supposed to remember all of the lessons that Jesus taught us in his actions and in his words, bringing people together around the table again and again and again to share, to be together, to be in community. It's about discipleship. It's about teaching one another. Just like I invited the children this morning to help with communion. We teach each other. Everyone gets a chance to participate because this is what we do at the heart of Christianity. At the very heart of it, it is this meal. It is coming together. It is sharing. And we have to model that, and we have to practice it, and we have to allow people to try it and teach them how to do it because it's hard work. It's hard work. Communities have tried and messed it up for years, but we keep trying and we keep practicing. And it's about that discipleship. It's about togetherness. Jesus did not eat alone. In this meal, he had many people with him. He always broke bread in a group, in community, with a diverse group of people, some which he had known for a long time and some which he had just met, just pulled off the street, just shared with. Maybe they had just appeared, but he was together in a group. When we break bread and eat it ourselves, it's not the same as when we break bread with someone else. The Bible tells us that whenever two or three are gathered in his name, Jesus is there with them. God is there with them. And so togetherness is so important. He tells us to wait for one another. That's important. Waiting for one another. Making sure the table is open for one another. Not just the people in this community, but are we waiting for everyone in society? Everyone that may be forgotten. Everyone that might not have enough. Are we waiting for one another? And finally, it's about the good news. Sharing the good news. Whenever you do this in remembrance of me. This is my body given for you. This is the cup of the new covenant. This is about the good news, not just words, not speaking the good news, sharing it. There is a better possibility for the vision of society as we know it. Jesus came to teach us what the kingdom of heaven here on earth could look like right now, where everybody has enough, where everyone can peacefully coexist, where everyone can love one another truly, where there is true justice. And when we all sit together around a table and share, we get a little glimpse of that. And that's so important. That is the good news. So every time we gather in a circle together and we sing shalom and we share a single loaf of bread and it's always enough for however many people are here, it's always enough. We get a little glimpse, just a little taste of what that peace of heaven looks like right here and right now. And so we see Paul teaching this to the Corinthians, teaching them. What you're doing is not what it was supposed to be. This is what it's supposed to be. Gratitude, remembrance, the good news, discipleship, togetherness, and waiting for one another. Can I get an amen to that?
Amen.
Amen.